Parkcast, the UK's original theme park podcast.
Welcome back to Parkcast, park fans. If you don't know by now, we're a podcast for theme park fans. I'm Bex, this is Kev.
Hello.
And we loved having you with us. We're here to chat about all things going on in the theme park industry, stuff that's happening in the UK, sometimes stuff a bit further afield as well. And we're just basically nerds who like having a chat. So if that's you, you're very welcome to join us here. Kev, as you may know, I mean, he's mentioned it once or twice. Occasionally it gets brought up. You quite like dark rides.
They're all right.
Like, I would always class myself as a roller coaster enthusiast. Mm-hmm. I would say you're a dark ride enthusiast.
I'm a dark ride enthusiast, but I do love my coasters. That's why I've always said Twilight Zone Tower of Terror is my all-time favorite attraction, because it combines those two amazing elements of dark ride, but has that thrill element in it. So you still get your thrill element from your coaster kind of ejector seat kind of airtime feeling, and you get a dark ride. But yeah, I love dark rides and have done since I was very little.
They were kind of what got you into the whole theme park community, really, weren't they? Because they were such a big thing for you. Well, you'll be very pleased to hear, Kev, I've sorted this episode especially for you.
Okay.
And I've got not one but two guests for us today. I've got Andy Sinclair Harris and Alex Tyrrell. Now, they're both from a company called Catapult. They are a themed attraction design company, and they're based right here in the UK in Derby. Alex and Andy, hello. Welcome to Parkcast.
Hi, Bex. Hi, Kev. Thanks for having us.
Hello. You're Thank welcome. You. Nice to be here.
You're very welcome. Now, you guys work for Catapult, as I said, and you kind of class yourselves as a themed attraction design company. You've worked with theme parks all around the world. You've worked on some massive attractions, and we'll find out all about that. But you also both individually, prior to joining Catapult, have had quite interesting careers. Andy, you were a Walt Disney World Imagineer.
I was, yes.
How did you get into that?
Oh my God, that would be another podcast, I would say, but I'll give you the abridged version. Basically, went to Disney as a kid when I was very, very young, because I'm quite old. Really enjoyed it and loved it. And there was a program on BBC TV, I think, which was about the making of Space Mountain for Disneyland Paris. Another, Kev, amazing kind of roller coaster.
Oh, yeah, Bex, absolutely.
One of my favorites. And I just remember thinking, what an amazing thing to have, like, these people who design rides. And you went round to Glendale, to Flower Street, to Imagineering. You saw these people. There was Tim Delaney and Marty Sklar. I was like, oh my goodness, these are the people who do it. So it kind of like sat in the back of my head. And, you know, I thought I would do my best to kind of do that. And I ended up studying theatre, fast forward quite a way, ended up doing theatre design with always the intention of that. And just by coincidence at my university, my drama school, they had connections to Disneyland Paris. And this lady came over and she kind of reviewed our portfolios and our work. And she said, have you ever heard of Imagineering? You should have a look at that. I was like, I tried to be cool. I was like, I've heard of that. Yeah. And I met with them and online and stuff like that. And we, you know, it was almost 8 years of talking to them of back and forth and stuff with Disneyland Paris. I did freelance. Wow. And then my first official role was with Hong Kong Disneyland. And I moved out there, spent 4 years in Hong Kong Disneyland and then to Walt Disney World. So it was a long gestation, but entirely worth it.
Wow. I'm sure, Kev, you've got a million questions that you'd want to ask about that.
I think, like, for someone who's a massive fan of Disney parks, and, you know, I've watched the Imagineering series on Disney Plus,
good, yeah.
And I've got the book, you know, and everything. But I think the thing for us as fans is you're given quite this picturesque view of what being an Imagineer must be like. Can you give us a bit of an insight into, you know, what kind of like your day-to-day sort of thing would have been like?
I mean, to be honest with you, I don't want to obviously shatter any illusions, but it is a fantastic job. It was probably one of the highlights of my career. It very much lived up to my expectations, because the people I got to work with were amazing. I got to meet Marty Sklar twice, which was amazing. Got to meet some, you know, we worked with Joe Reddy a little bit, and you have to think of yourself in that moment like you're a professional. You're in that moment as a, it's a role, you know, even though you've seen these people, you're aware of them within the industry. But the variety of the jobs were amazing. And for me, it was always a privilege to do anything that was going into a Walt Disney, you know, park that had that name and that, you know, around it. So even if it was, I mean, I did pool fences for hotels and I did water parks, but I also did, you know, restaurants and things. And it was every single job was a real privilege, because everyone was very much invested in, can we do the best? And you got to work with these amazing people. But it was a real privilege just to do anything to do with a Disney park, obviously.
And when you were working at Hong Kong Disneyland,
yeah,
like, obviously you worked on the Toy Story Land area.
I did, yes.
How did they decide, like, okay, Andy, you're going to do this bit. This is your task. Or do you go, I'll do that, or how does it work?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think it's not quite. I wish it was a bit more. If Alex is on this call, he's incredibly organized, and would it would have been a different given case. But at the time, I came over there for the expansion because obviously, as you guys remember, back in 2010, 11, they'd announced a raft of expansion for Hong Kong Disneyland. So it was those three kind of like decent sized lands. It was Toy Story, Grizzly, and then Mystic. I think I can't remember the order in which they happened, but I was on Toy Story Land. And the piece that I was kind of working was actually Andy's Toy Box, which was quite amusing because everyone thought it was named after me, which was great. It was like, so I was on that.
Oh,
It was
yeah, of course.
just like, it's great. I've got a mug for like a project team mug with my name on it, and it was quite hilarious. But so it was for that one, it was more about who was, we had a very small team, and we kind of, you have to divide and conquer with those kinds of projects. So I did some of the, show set design for the interior of that. Got to make a game, a Woody's kind of roundup game for that, because obviously we needed to use kind of like pretend money for some of the giant show sets. So I got to work with Pixar on designing that. So it was very much like a who can do these jobs, that who is kind of available. And as Alex will know, sometimes things happen where you can plan things. Other times it's very much who's free, who can do that.
Must have been an amazing experience. And yeah, Alex, obviously you're here as well. And you're more on the sort of AV side of things, aren't you? But I mean, you've worked on some massive projects as well. You've worked with Disney, you've worked in Abu Dhabi. Tell us about some of the things that you've done.
So I was a project manager for a big company called Catapult, called Electrosonic. So they're a very large design and integration company. They do technology, and really were kind of like at the forefront of their time. Especially with R&D, they used to have a product range. They kind of were the first people to do digital video devices, to kind of have to integrate into show systems and show control. And yeah, that was a really, 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 really fun job. Busy because everything was at the construction time, so everything was full steam ahead. Everything had to be done on time, managing procurement cycles. But yeah, I mean, one of my last projects I completed before leaving was Marvel's Avengers Campus at Disneyland Paris, and that was at such a really interesting time because that was being built during the pandemic, and Disney have very, very strict testing policies and procedures where they have to come to your fabrication facility and they have to see how everything's built. They thoroughly inspect it. And we weren't able to do that because of social distancing. So we had to invent this new sort of testing with cameras that had to be put very, very close into to see every single connection to make sure it was all kind of done remotely. When we were able to, we were then shipped the equipment to site, and Disney's integration team plugged it all in, and thankfully it worked. So.
It was a hold your breath moment.
Which attraction was that?
The Rock and Roller Coaster re-theme, and it was the Spider-Man ride.
Fantastic. Both really good. I love what they've done with Rock and Roller Coaster. The Iron Man animatronic particularly is breathtaking when you see it. And that's what I love about Disney parks particularly, is because you have that, as someone who loved all the Marvel films. Even at the age I am, walking into that world, you get that giddy kind of, oh my goodness, I'm almost living in this experience, this world, with the music playing. But even the Spider-Man attraction was great because all three of my children can go on it and join in with it, and that's what Disney do so well at. There was no height restriction on it, and it's great when you're seeing their reaction, like in the pre-show and all the special effects, and it's such a wonderful thing as a parent with your kids going to Disney parks, and they're like walking into Avengers Campus, even though they might not be as big a Marvel fan as me, but just seeing their like expression of how do they do that? Don't
It's
ask
such a,
me. Even
it's
though
so
I've got a
fun.
book, I still don't know some of this stuff, how you do it.
It's so fun, and I appreciate you talking about having that sort of gameplay with your kids as well on the Spider-Man ride, because it's really, really fun. You can just be, you can either go full hog on it and be like, I'm gonna really do this, or you can just kind of like just enjoy the scenery and enjoy the visuals there, because it's very, very high quality video that they've got in there, and then in the yeah, it's a super fun system that they use for the gameplay. And that's what's really fun about connecting families together, having fun with your family. So it's a very inclusive attraction in that way.
And I think it's a good one for Paris because Disneyland Paris, particularly all of their dark rides, that is literally the only one that is really screen based. And I know there's always a big debate between enthusiasts when it comes to dark rides about screen or not screen, and whether do you just go all out practical effects. I know there's Ratatouille as well, sorry, at Disneyland Paris as well. But in terms of like that kind of interactive screen element, I think it works really well. And it's nice at Paris, you get that nice variety of dark rides.
It's a good balance. Yeah, it's a good balance, and it's interesting you kind of talk about the pros and cons of screen-based attractions, but when used correctly, they work very well to convey the story. It's kind of extending your field of view, especially if it's combined with lives with real sets. Then you feel further immersed. You can see greater distance, and it really brings you in properly. If the screen's hidden, yeah, it looks great. You shouldn't ever see technology in an attraction.
I agree with that.
It's
Yeah, technology
it's
should
there
be
just to
like
enhance
magic.
it as technology advances. And I think Disney is a really, really good example of waiting until the technology is available before they use it. If it can't be done, they won't make the attraction, and they'll wait until the technology is available, which really pushes companies like Electrosonic to kind of come up with really, really good solutions that are ahead of their time.
It's fascinating the things that you guys have worked on, and we're going to cover this so much more as we go through this. My kind of thoughts for today's episode were, do we in the UK not appreciate dark rides enough? Or do we not realize that we appreciate them enough? We've talked about Disney, we've done a lot about Disneyland Paris and the technology that they're using there with their dark rides. It's not really something that we've seen on dark attractions in this country yet. And it's not just at Disney, because we see it at places like Efteling, Europa Park. They love a dark ride, and they re as soon as that technology's out, they're there and they're using it. Symbolica at Efteling, incredible dark rides, really going to town with that trackless ride technology. And yet we haven't really cottoned onto it here, and we don't have a major dark ride attraction in the UK that we're like, that's the one that everyone kind of looks to. So I think it's quite an interesting discussion to see where we are in the UK and what's happening elsewhere and where the technology is going and where you guys who work in the industry kind of see dark rides going, and what you're working on now and what we might see in the future. Because looking back, the UK was kind of a really good pioneer of dark rides. You look at something like, really, really, really going back, the River Caves at Blackpool Pleasure Beach. What an amazing themed attraction that must have seemed when it first opened.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I totally agree. And I think b before we kind of go into a bit more detail, it's good to kind of explain what a dark ride actually is, because it's a ride in the dark. It's an attraction in the dark, right? But there are lots of different versions of that. So like people could consider flying cinemas dark rides. You could consider the Vekoma Madhouses as dark rides, not just ones that are on tracks or trackless systems that go around to different scenes. Even well-themed indoor water rides like Valhalla at Blackpool is it could be considered as a dark ride. So yeah, there are quite a few in the UK that you've got Gangster Granny in Alton Towers, you've got Curse of Alton Manor, you've got the Legoland Flying Cinema, you've got the Gruffalo ride at Chessington, which was a refresh, you've got Valhalla at Blackpool, you've got Monsters Party at Legoland. There are quite a few, and there's also that new Cadbury's attraction as well, which is also a
Oh, yeah,
dark
of
ride.
course. Yeah, that's right.
And trackless, right?
Yeah, trackless. It's the EFT ride system. So there are quite a few, but I think you made a good point, Bex, when you said that there's not one that you think, wow, that is like, I don't know, that is
The gold standard.
the exactly in the UK, and there isn't that yet.
Enter Universal.
Oh yeah, Bedford. Yeah,
Yes, Bedford.
But then I think when you got to think these parks are in the UK are quite economically driven, so they need to rely on things like IP buy-in, which Disney don't have to pay for,
Yeah.
and those are very expensive contracts. And also, we're trying to attract park numbers and boost attendance with new attractions, because attractions are expensive. These dark rides are expensive, and well, every new attraction is expensive, but you do need to kind of get more revenue in. So you need to have a good marketing campaign behind it, and you need to have a hitch. And that is usually something like the biggest, the fastest, the tallest. That's quite a lot what we see a lot of in the UK, because they are big pullers that increase guest attendance. But going back, like I'm a nostalgia guy. I love the Bubbleworks at Chessington. It was like my I
I
think that
remember
was
it
my
well.
first
Remember it well.
ever induction into dark rides. I think we can all remember the smell. And
Yeah.
it's so, and that again, scent is such an important thing when you're working with
Absolutely.
attractions, because not only does it, further immerse you into a space, but also you have that memory of it. So you can really, really relive being back in there again.
And that was the thing with the Bubbleworks and obviously the Haunted House around the same time. Classic John Wardley attractions, which Kev knows inside out, knows, loves, adores them. His background being like film and theatre, he wanted to bring that theatricality to it, didn't he? And which he did so well. And his whole, we did an interview with him last year, and his whole thing was he wanted people to really feel something when you were riding these attractions. It wasn't enough to just go round. You had to feel like you were really, really in it and in a world. And I guess, I don't know, Kev, correct me if I'm wrong. I guess he kind of took inspiration from what Disney were doing at the
Yeah, I
time when he
think
was doing it.
absolutely. I think I certainly feel like the great thing that what John took from the Disney kind of parks idea was that you were being taken into a whole nother world that you could be immersed in. So like the idea of Fantasyland at Disneyland was to take you into the films that you had watched, the animation films that you'd been watching, so you could be a part of it. And that's what John Wardley did, particularly with the Bubbleworks and the Haunted House. And I think both of them worked really well. And the Haunted House particularly worked really well because he tried to do something that was like Disney, but different in that it wasn't an omni-mover system. You were on a car that could be controlled at different speeds, which was the first at the time. No one had ever done that on a ghost train type ride before, where the car could speed up and slow down at different sections. So that you were only a couple of times, I think there was twice on the Haunted House where you could see another car, but the majority of the rest of the ride, you were on your own. And that was the idea. You're on your own in this little car going around a haunted house. And I think that's what made that ride really good. And I think John Wardley's idea of the queue line is part of the attraction too. And it's not just cattle pen and then you're in, that you had the graveyard outside, you had the walkthrough section into the house with the pre-show kind of area with all the different things going on around you to immerse you in, and then you are on the ride. But for me, it was Pirate Adventure at Drayton Manor was the first kind of major dark ride I went on.
Did you guys ever go on that?
I did. I had family near Staffordshire, so I think I went on it, but I can't remember it very well because I'd been to Disneyland Paris at a similar sort of time. I'm kind of conflating the two, but I vaguely remember it. Yeah, it
An
was very
inspired
similar.
by, isn't it?
Yeah, takes lovely
It
cues from, electrical
does.
inspiration from.
I was 5 when it was in 19 when it opened in 1990, and I'd not been to any Disney park, so like I had no idea about Pirates of the Caribbean. And so when I went on it, it just blew me away. And it's so different to what a roller coaster can do, because with a dark ride, you can be taken out of where you are and put into somewhere else and completely forget where you are for that kind of
It's
moment in time.
escapism, isn't it?
Do you have any other memories, Andy, of like dark rides in the 90s growing up? Any particular that stand out for you?
Well, going back, because when you mentioned smell, Alex, it just really triggered me because, in a good way, triggered in a good way. But I remember Horizons, the orange smell on Horizons, for those of you who know about that attraction. So that was one of the first ones going to Epcot. Epcot was really inspirational to me when I went there as a kid, and going on Spaceship Earth, and just I was at that age where things are, there's an artificiality to it, but you're kind of enjoying the magic trick. You can see it. So I was that kind of geeky kid on the ride who was looking down and seeing the ride system. And then you think, oh, these are kind of robots stood on these things and they're organized in a certain way. But Horizons was just wonderful because it was this the whole point of the ride, really, about Horizons was everything's going to be okay. You're going into an optimistic future. It was the same with the Living Seas, actually. Like, one of my biggest standouts, to go back to your point, Kev, was that you don't really get on before you get onto the what was the kind of like the Omnimover within the tanks there. You had to
That's
go down
right.
to the hydrolator, which wasn't a real lift. But at the time, you were like, I think everyone would say, I think we're going underwater because you have that wonderful bubble effect. The floor shook. There is absolutely no reason to do that. There's no reason for Disney to have done that. But it is part of that ongoing story. So the story is we're going down to Sea Base Alpha. We're descending underwater. So we can't just walk from one room to another. That wouldn't be part of the story. So to commit to that as a, and I think that's to your point, Kev, what Disney do, because that commitment to story, and that, where the story is king. And so budget and things like that have to be factored into the storytelling. So having the elevator and doing that as an effect to then walk out, it's adding to that wonderment before you get to the ride that you feel like you've descended. So Horizons, as you said, was a big one because it was you had the amazing, I think they're called the Omnimax theaters, where you went in there and saw those huge IMAX displays. But every scene of that just really washed over me. But and going back to what you were saying earlier, the fact that about John Wardley working on that is because it's a story. A dark ride is a story, and Walt's early Imagineers had come from animation. So what we know about theme parks today from those early kind of incredible legends, the men and women who did that, they were coming from an animation background, so they understood color and texture and paint, but how we transition from scene to scene. So it's not a film, it's not a piece of theatre, it's this hybrid, and I think it's that wonderful intersection. But you have to understand storytelling, you have to understand scenography and those kind of things. And the rides that do that so well are the ones that get all of those kind of unique things right.
That's why Hex works well at Alton Towers.
Oh, yeah. Quite creepy, isn't it? Yeah.
Because it was a really brave decision to go with like the tale of the Earl of Shrewsbury and the tree getting
Let's
chained
create
up
their
and
own
all those
IP in a
things.
sense,
And
right?
actually to create a ride from that story was very brave of them, but it works really well because like you say, Andy, you what you're doing is taking a story and walking people through the story with things happening and weird stuff and when you add music and all these things, I remember Nick Varney mentioned it in an interview. He said, like, a great dark ride is like an orchestra, and you've got all these moving pieces, and you have to have the person who is, the conductor to put it all together. But you've got all these moving pieces. Why dark rides are so difficult, really, to put together well is because you're combining your audience, understanding your audience, understanding a story, practical effects. You've got sound, you've got music, all of these things you're trying to fit together. And that's why when I look at like the Bubble Works, particularly the Haunted House at Alton Towers, Twinland Tours at Alton Towers, I'm going to throw that one in there as well. That was, all these different things happening. For me, always made a really good dark ride. Phantom Manor at Disneyland Paris as well is another
Oh,
one where it's so clever because you're at a multi-language park with people speaking different languages. So they're like, okay, what do we do? Because in the Haunted Mansion in the US, it's narrator driven, but you can't do that at Paris where you've got multi different languages. So what do? Use it through music. And the music tells the story. Obviously, all the animatronics are doing all their thing, but it's the music that tells the story and that attraction. And
And
for
Disneyland
me,
Paris has their version of their Haunted Mansion is much more story driven than just going to random scenes in a mansion, which you get in the America parks. Be and they have to do that because they tie it into the land. They have the Ravenswood family. They have that story. They make it part of it. They've recently done a say recently, but they have done a refresh
Yeah, it's really
of that
recent.
attraction to try and enhance that story even further and make it very clear, about the bride and what she's doing, and just so. And as you're right, because you have so many guests speaking different languages, it has to be very, very simple, and we have to convey a story very quickly because this system isn't going to stop moving; it moves at the same pace. And you have to make sure that that story is maintained and is very clear of what's going on in each scene. So yeah, I mean, that's the important thing. A dark ride is a show, and it needs to be observed as well as it's important to recognize that you got to always have a good show, and that attraction has to be kept running. And each element of that attraction, like in the orchestra,
analogy.
description there that you've got to have all those pieces well maintained. They've all got to be performing optimally, constantly, all the time, because these dark rides have usually very high throughputs as well. So it's thousands of guests an hour that are experiencing this, that you've got to have a perfect show for every single time. And any piece that's not working, then you break that illusion, you break that magic.
I mean, we talk about this on this podcast a lot. Kev's biggest bugbear is the scene in Haunted House, Jewel, Curse of Otton Manor, which is the Trommel Tunnel, which for the last season or so hasn't really been working at Alton Towers.
I
And
know.
like you say, it's a massive piece of theming scenery, which when it's not working, it does kind of detract a little bit,
Effects
because
for the
not
show,
only do you not get the disorientation of having it working, you've not got anything at that point. It's silent, it's dark. You've come from a very immersive scene into a few seconds of should something be happening here? So
And that's
yeah,
one of the things
that's
that Disney do really well, is that, and when I was at Disney, one of the teams that I was on for a certain time was what was called the SQS team at the time, which is show quality standards. So the fact that Disney have, I mean, for example, like take Pirates in Disneyland, there is troves and troves of books about how the pirates should be. So it's like a theatre production. Alex and I both work in theatre as well, but when you have that first night, when the director and all the company have done that, that's how you would like that show to be seen every single time. And we always have to, and I think you always have to remember as ride creators and designers that, just because, the first week is perfect, everything's great. If you fast forward 8 years to that, and Tony Baxter always talks about that as well, that you don't design a ride for the first go. We've been designing at Catapult a ride recently, a dark ride, which I can't talk about, but
Just a little
but
teaser.
a little tease. But
Tell us
it's
afterwards.
it's not about designing that. I've been talking to the team. We don't design it for that first go. You do design it for the 50th time. Why would someone want to come back with their family? Kev bring his kids back again and again because of those story points. And yet again, not to get into the weeds of designing a ride, but we've been talking about recently how if you have figures there, I mean, because I've kind of semi come from an animation background as well, and we talk about when we design the figures that you should silhouette them like you do in animation. So silhouette them to completely darken them out. And so if you could just see them in silhouette without any form, could you tell what they were doing? If they're pointing, if they're gesturing, if the sound went out on your ride, would guests know what they're doing about? It's this kind of visual literacy that I, really bang on about with the team. And the fact that you could take that ride and it wouldn't necessarily be dependent on a narration or something. Like, as you said, Kev, music is important, sound effects. But if you can get a sense of that through just what you're seeing and observing, and a lot of dark rides, you don't have a lot of time to tell a story. It's not like reading a book or a film where you can sit through a prequel. You've got seconds in a scene to see two characters. What are they doing? What are their intentions? How do I feel about them? How do I feel in this scene? And all of that, to go back to your orchestra point, Kev, is very much a conductor job that Alex and I have to do, to kind of sell that scene in a few seconds. And and also, just following up from what we're saying, make sure that park maintains those creative intent, which sometimes they don't. And obviously, that is it's very much a contract that you have to take on board as an operator. The fact that, going back to your point, Bex, if that tunnel isn't working, we would see that as a, and let's not mention the Yeti at Expedition Everest, because that's one of the biggest bugbears that the fan community have about
Oh, yeah.
that. But because you can make a point, the operations team can say, look, if we take this ride down to fix that, it's a very large fix to do that thing. So it's going to have a negative impact on guests' operations and things like that. But from a show standard, you'd want that to be working, because it's a really big, really big end point. It's the finale to that incredible roller coaster.
Well, John Wardley mentioned that, didn't he, Bex, when we interviewed him last year, and he made the point that when he designed the haunted house, they built it, and then the idea was to keep adding new things over the years.
Yeah.
So you would keep adding new effects in
Keeping
because
it
you
really
want it to keep
fresh.
lasting. Yeah, you
That's
want to keep
yes.
it fresh because you
That's a
don't want
great idea, yeah.
people to keep coming back again, because that's what happened with the haunted house. Was it after
Yeah.
10 years, nothing new had been added, and actually it'd been just left. So no one had gone in
Yeah.
and said, let's
Yeah.
fix this, let's fix that. It just got left. And he was very disappointed, because what he was saying was that when Nemesis opened in 94, they'd already said, well, the Haunted House is doing really well. We're focused on Nemesis. We don't need to go back to it. And then in 96, they built the hotel. They were doing all these things. This was the next
Right.
thing. Then Oblivion was the next kind of big thing. They were focusing on these things. They
On
didn't
the
want to go
coasters,
back
yeah.
to it. And do you think that's kind of a problem we have in the UK with our dark rides?
Well, they're very expensive, and the more moving parts that you have in them, Like, especially if you've got animatronics, moving figures, you've got moving set pieces, you've got lighting, you've got sound system, you've got possibly a video system as well, and you've got the ride system, and you've got all of the climate control in the building and everything. So it's very, very expensive to that, and that might be off-putting to some operators because they recognize that it's not just putting a coaster outside and putting a sign in front of it and saying it's open. You've got to do a lot of work and you've got to have multiple disciplinary teams. I'm not saying I'm making it out like a coaster, it's very simple, but in comparison to having a dark ride, yeah, there's so many more moving parts that you've got to control to get into the design of it, build it, and then the maintenance. And that might be off-putting to operators because it's a long-term investment.
Alex
Seen it
makes a really
happen
good
with
point there with the multidisciplinary teams. I think that's exactly what it is. The fact that you can't necessarily ask an operations team to know all the effects that are working. And that's kind of going back to what we were saying about that show quality standard guide. You want, so what does what does the Haunted Mansion look like on day one? And you kind of need a team to be there to be looking at that, art directors on site to be saying, okay, the tunnel's not working today, or this scene is low lit, because things like lights and effects can go really quickly, like smoke machines. There are all those long working effects that can sometimes just decline by degrees. And I think that's a terrible thing to creep into attractions, that declining by degrees. So we've got to be, as creatives, you want that to be maintained. But sometimes it's a lot to ask of a local team because they're really maintaining their main priority is guest safety. That's the first thing we should always think about. And then after that, you kind of get into the literal nuts and bolts. How are these wheels doing? Do I need to order another fuse box for this, the electronics? And then unfortunately, you might not notice that the light that hit that tree in scene five is out, and they don't notice that. So I think it's to do with maybe it's not the right kind of planning at the beginning, or certainly not the right kind of creative maintenance. Maybe it's creative maintenance. It has to be a partnership, as Alex said, I think.
And it's important to recognize that, and to all the ride operators out there, it's not the ride operator's responsibility or job to ensure that that ride is a perfect show every time. Their job is to open it and make sure, and as I said, as Andy said, like keep guest safety and keep ride throughput. So you still have guests going on that ride, so it's not closed down. So you still make sure that your guests are evenly distributed around the park. You're not getting too busy areas or too crowded areas, and they just have to open it and run it. And they've got a lot of stuff to do in a day when they're operating that ride. Yeah, not all parks have the creative team on site able to inspect them and make sure that the show is being displayed as it was intended.
But the thing that I get frustrated with is, and I've done this before, so when the Curse at Alton Manor opened, will be 2 years ago now, the problem is that first year I was like, I'm going to enjoy it as it is, which is, which is a sad thing to think, is
Oh,
that
that's a
I'm going to
shame.
take
That's a
this
sad
in now
indictment of
because
that.
the problem is, and it's happened throughout so many years with other rides, that enjoy it in its first year opening because, like we've had with Trommel Tunnel not working, some effects aren't working as they were. This is the problem. You get to the point now, it's like, well, I enjoyed it while it was working. And I've always said, they invested so much money in the Curse at Alton Manor. For me, with Valhalla as one of the best dark rides in the country. And the reason for that was because the amount of effort they'd put into obviously what John Burton had done, he'd obviously followed the John Wardley model and create this really immersive, great dark ride. But are the park, are Merlin going to put money to one side to keep that maintained so the level is exactly the same as it was on opening 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years later? Is it still going to have the same impact? You always hope so, but I think that's one of the issues we have, and why like rides like Pirate Adventure closed at Drayton Manor because of the cost and because it was left and everything was just forgotten about.
Valhalla's an interesting one as well that you mentioned, because obviously we saw that just a couple of years ago go through a multi-million pound refurb. And Blackpool Pleasure Beach isn't a park that you traditionally associate with really heavily themed attractions. And it was always quite interesting that they put Valhalla in the first place, because it was a seaside amusement park and it was very much stick a ride down, off we go. And then so put in this ride which had so many effects, and literally you've got fire, ice, light, sounds, smells. It was a really interesting choice for them to put that in, but as we mentioned at the start, they were kind of the pioneers with river caves and stuff, so maybe in a way they had had that history. But the joke amongst enthusiasts with Valhalla is you've got to ride it first in the day, because if you ride it in the afternoon, the effects won't be working. And it's really sad that we have to think in that way. And as you guys have said, these things cost a lot of money. There's so much effort that has to go into maintaining it. You need someone to be going around it each day, like with a little notebook going, this isn't working today, this isn't. And then if it's not working, what do you do? Do you close it for the day? Mm. It's that balance, I guess, of keeping guests happy and or just not providing them the ride experience.
And Alex and I talked about this because, again, going back to our theatrical kind of background, that you have shows that have been running in the West End for literal decades now, but they have employed, you know, show directors to kind of maintain, say it's, you know, Les Miserables, Phantom of the Opera. They're maintaining that show intent from the 1980s, for example, and they have to, like, you know, they want that original intent for potentially a director who's no longer alive, a designer who's no longer alive. But what was that original intent? How are we maintaining that? Because, you know, that show is not just going to, you know, continue day after day without any kind of creative checks on it. People would, you know, it's going to become a real, you know, facsimile of its first day. So, but we don't, to your point, we don't tend to do that with our dark rides and our attractions, because roller coasters, you know, have, as you said, I think, Kev, there is a uniqueness to them, which is maybe easier to distinguish. You know, these bolts aren't working. That's, you know, there's it's electronically based. But because we're talking about show, the more theatrical you get, the more creative endeavors you get, it's more of that maintenance, which a lot of these parks just don't have the capex potentially to invest in that team to be going around and doing that. And I think that's why we see these kind of, like we said, you know, declining by degrees, which is really sad. I didn't know that about Valhalla, that the afternoon's not, I mean, that's a shame. You want that great intent for guests. We tried to aim for it, you know, speaker guests, but we would want that intent throughout for every single guest. So, yeah.
And I don't want to do Valhalla any disservice here. I think in terms of dark rides in the UK, it's, if not the number one, it's certainly top three, you know, in terms of well-themed attractions, it's incredible. And we all know Amanda Thompson is, again, she's theatrically based, you know, Hot Ice. That is her background. Mm. She likes to put on a show. And I'm sure she doesn't like that attraction not working as much we don't. But it's just one of those things when there's so many things within it, which could and do go wrong. It becomes a bit of a nightmare to manage. Yeah. But if you do get a run through when everything's working, wow, what a phenomenal experience that ride is. We've mentioned John Wardley and the Haunted House quite a bit, and I thought this is an interesting thing, and maybe Alex, you can give us some reading on this as well. When we interviewed him, as Kev mentioned, he was quite disappointed about the fact that the Haunted House didn't get the yearly investment, which he'd kind of understood was going to be the case, to the point where Alton Towers said, right, the ride's closing and we're going to retheme it as Jewel. And John didn't mince his words when he spoke to us. If you've not heard that episode, by the way, do go back and listen to it. Fascinating interview. He hated Jewel. He absolutely hated the fact that his dark ride had become interactive and in his words, had become a game. Now, you guys obviously work on projects which involve AV and gameplay, and it's the way that a lot of dark rides have gone in recent times. What are your kind of thoughts on the use of that kind of technology in dark rides now? Did you think I can see John's point, or were you like, well, something needed to change, the public wanted something new?
I think as a creative, when you put something into the world, like a very nice attraction, very lovely ride that you put, you know, years of work into, and only for the operator to make an executive decision to change the guest experience, probably without consulting you first, I guess, in John Wardley's case, then obviously that can be very disappointing to hear. But there's often good business cases to support why you want interactivity, why you need to refresh these attractions. And I guess to what I was saying earlier, you know, to these things cost money. They obviously recognize the attraction needed a refresh, but they also needed to bring in more people. And they do that by plugging, what's the catch, what's the hitch here? That is the shooting element. And that will bring more people in because it's exciting, it's new, it's different. We can also then spend more money on upgrading the attraction, upgrading the effects. So that might have been a business case to support that additional interactive element. I really like interactive rides. I really like it because I feel like it's family togetherness, or you go with your friends. Scoring is really fun because you can feel competitive. You're also seeing these lovely sets, and you are experiencing a ride, especially when if the ride's been designed like that from the beginning. And there are some really, really good examples of shooting rides. One of my favorites is in Tokyo Disney with the monster. It's the Monsters Inc.
Hide and go seek, I think.
Oh, such a good
Yeah, it looks
execution there,
amazing.
because you're not shooting anything, which sometimes I take an issue with using guns and weapons, but you're just highlighting things with torches, and that's also a really, really fun explorative way of interacting with a ride.
I think you make a really good point there. It is the execution of it. I think when Duel came out, the technology was very new. I think John said literally someone had seen it on IAPA and said, we'll buy one of those.
That's how
And
it
so
happens, yeah.
it
They've done it
wasn't.
to Toon Blaster, didn't they? So they had Terror Toon at Chessington the
One
year
of my
before
favorite
Duel
rides.
opened, and they obviously put the guns onto Terror Toon to make it Toon Blaster, and obviously the year after they did the same with the Haunted House into Duel. So they'd obviously seen this technology and gone,
That's a really good point,
isn't.
Kev, because I remember the Terror Toon, and one of my that was my, again one of my early. It used to terrify me, actually. I was quite small, and I'm a very sensitive person. But this but I did really enjoy it. But I did think when they added in the shooting, you missed the scene. You were focusing more on the action. Of your of scoring or looking at all the lights and getting a score up, and you missed the story, which is what goes back to what I said earlier. If the ride's been designed with the intent that it's going to be an interactive shooter ride, then it works better than if you overlay a shooting element into something that already wasn't meant for that purpose. Scenes were scenes and timing and show was specifically for you to enjoy each moment that you're there, rather than focus on like other things. You're completely missing other stuff.
Like Midway Mania, Buzz Lightyear, Laser Blast, you go on that because it's been specifically designed to be that kind of ride. Whereas I think that's why it's always disappointing on certain dark rides that you've experienced it for years one way and then it's been changed into a different element. The problem, like you said, Alex, is because Duel was a haunted house originally. It was set up in that premise. So then when you start just putting LED lights just on the walls and on pillars and on things, you're not really taking in what the original ride was. Whereas like Midway Mania is amazing fun with your family. Yes, it's screen-based, but the idea is it is that kind of fun gaming element where you compete with other people because that was the way it was designed to be.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can talk about this for so long. There's so much that we can bring into it. Just thinking about what you guys do now at Catapult. Obviously, as we said, you're a themed attraction design company. You've worked with parks all over the world, and you've done a lot on dark rides. Clearly, you've got one in the works at the moment that you can't talk about. Keeping very hush on that. What's the general feeling that you guys get at the moment from guests in your sort of research around dark rides? And what kind of feedback are you getting as a company from parks when they're looking at dark rides? Are there objections to it?
Well, we did some research back in last year to ask theme park fans about their overall experience of parks, and we also asked for their opinions on dark rides. Their feedback was that 65% agreed that dark rides are more immersive than other rides, and I know immersive is a buzzword, but we'll come back to that perhaps. And then 52% experienced technical difficulties on dark rides,
Which is a
and
lot.
yeah, it is, but that doesn't have a lasting negative impact on their overall day out experience. I think it's more like they noted that there was a technical problem, but they still had a good time at the park, and they because there's other offerings there. So yeah, I think experience wise, we know that that a high percentage of people like dark rides, like having that feeling of immersion, like having things to look at, having nice sets, and it just makes it much more tactile and real, rather than just sitting on a coaster and going up and down and having some fun bunny hops and air times, which we really enjoy. But there is something completely different by going in a dark ride. So there's definitely we do see that there is, the from an audience perspective, there is a demand and a need for it. But then again, from a practical operation, CapEx perspective, these are very expensive, complex things.
The thing is, compared to a roller coaster, it's more inclusive in a way, because there's so many people who just say, I do not like roller coasters. I won't get on a roller coaster. A dark ride is more of a gentle introduction into a ride experience. Most people in a family can go on it, grandparents, very young children. Mm. Like you say, you can share that family experience. So there's definitely good reason for parks to install them. In terms of what you guys have seen, where do you think the technology is going? What might we see in the future? What might be coming our way? What are you guys excited about to put into dark rides in the future?
I guess looking ahead, you can see, Rise of the Resistance, for example, is extremely technical and very immersive, still a very heavy on IP. And Universal Epic Universe is opening with some unique ride systems and effects. I think it's important to note, though, those are really big players with really big pockets. But I don't think the future necessarily means to spend lots of money, but I do think it means to give guests a further and deeper level of immersion. And perhaps, Andy, when we talk about what is the future of dark rides, I think story is certainly is important. How does that story factor into it? Where does it go?
Yeah, I definitely think we're on a kind of march back to basics, I think. I think it's, like we talked about, it's a commitment to story. Technology has now helped us so much. And obviously we've got things like AI and there's all these buzzwords going around right now. But really, the fundamentals of dark rides haven't changed. They are the same principles of great story told well, technology, not for technology's sake, but to have it be magic. I think there is an Arthur C. Clarke comment I'm going to butcher, but something about, technology is like a magic trick that's made real kind of thing. And it's indistinguishable between the two. So we kind of, as Catapult, we're excited by the use of technology. We're excited by all these amazing kind of the tools in our box that we can use. But at the same time, that's not what drives us. That's what telling great stories, making those deep memories for guests for a long, long time to come. And as Alex, we use the I word, immersion, but true immersion is something we really seek, that people are really enveloped in a particular story that we're designing. So that's what excites us. And like I said, having a greater palette of tools to play with is great, but it's how you use them, I think.
I know you can't tell us about your new attraction that you're working on at the moment, but in terms of your time at Catapult, what stood out to you as things that you've worked on that you've really enjoyed?
Goodness.
We have a really good partnership with Lego and the Lego group. It's very, very fun. Their whole ethos of hands-on play, that's really exciting. And to bring that into the parks as well and have the parks, allow their guests to have that space to have a hands-on play experience, that's really lovely as well. And we also work with Legoland Discovery Centres. Something that we've worked on recently, it's been really interesting as well for me, has been the tunnels in Gibraltar, because that's taking local stories of World War II and the Gibraltarian story and creating this not really a museum attraction, more like a heritage visitor attraction, and doing that. That's also been really unique and fun to work on. Of course, we've worked on other theme parks, other rides, some things we can't talk about because these things are in development for a long time. There are some really, really exciting things that we're working on now that will definitely open in the future, and we'll talk about them then when we can. Also working with IPs, we work a lot with IPs like Mattel, Hasbro, and that's really fun because you can really kind of pick up their brand and their story, and you guard that IP, you keep that, and it's so important to, when we design attractions using IPs, is to really kind of make sure that that's protected and you're kind of getting the best out of that. And that's what's really fun. And that's what's really fun working with a creative team is pulling out the story within the IP and putting a great attraction together.
Exactly. Everything that Alex just said. I mean, I've been with Catapult not quite 3 years yet. And we are still working on things from day one that haven't seen the light of day yet, haven't been able to come to fruition. But to Alex's point, we've been able to work with Lego. We've worked with Netflix. We've worked with Warner Brothers on things that haven't been announced yet, which has been fantastic. We've got a few good things in the fire. And it's part of the job that we do. I mean, when I was at Disney, And people used to say, tell me something you've worked on. And there was a handful of things that got, you know, that saw the light of day and got constructed, because we do work in an industry where you're pitching for things take, you know, the average, you know, ride or attraction can sometimes take about 4 years of development. So that's a long kind of gestation period. So, and as Alex kind of alluded to, that, you know, that the press release is when all the parties are allowed, you know, have agreed to say something, that's when you can talk about it. But we work on these things for a very, very long time. So my favorite things still remain three favorite letters, NDA'd at the moment. But but again, I think Catapult as a company, not just to kind of toot our own horn, I think we have such a fantastic team. We're a really collaborative bunch, and Phil and Dawn, our kind of founders, have created a wonderful kind of collaborative working environment. And we've managed to kind of wrangle some incredible people who are really talented, love what they do. And I kind of maintain, we say it all the time when we kind of meet up for our meetings, that I don't think there's anything that Catapult couldn't do, really. We're, you know, it's a really, really wonderful bunch. And I kind of oversee the design team, and they just blow me away with some of the stuff that they're doing and some of the projects we've been doing recently, as we've talked about. The team have just really, it's lit a fire under them to kind of work on these exciting projects, and excited for the future of where we're going to go with these things. And I think to end it kind of like talking about the UK, I think the future of the UK is really, really bright. And I hope it is, because obviously Universal are kind of like, there's potential for that, which I think we've been overdue, a big kind of one of the players. Obviously Disneyland Paris has been great, but something on our shores is even better. Poo de Fou are talking about something.
Yeah.
There was a Kinrun announcement, I think, yesterday. So there's some fantastic things happening. So I think the future is very, very bright. And, you know, we have some of the players in this country who can maybe, you know, do a little healthy competition, perhaps, to step up their game, which is great. So, you know, that kind of that saying that water kind of raises all ships, you know, everyone will kind of up their game. I think that's exactly what we're going to see in the kind of coming years.
I hope so. That's what we're kind of hoping for as enthusiasts as well.
Yeah, you know, I'm sure.
Add a bit more competition in, and also hopefully 365 Park opening. I mean, that's the one thing that we really, really, really desperately need to see.
Yeah, I think
we're at the end of
closed
season now. Yeah. We're all going a little bit crazy. Hence online, just, I think everything spirals online at the end of closed season, because enthusiasts just need something to talk about.
Yeah.
So yeah, we're all really hopeful for that. I think it's amazing.
I can see that.
I think it's amazing what you guys are doing. It's just this company based in Derby, and you're working on these amazing themed attractions all around the world. It's so good to have some homegrown talent and the things that you guys have worked on globally as well. It's just amazing. Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your knowledge and your expertise with us on Parkcast today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Before you both go, I've got one more question for you.
Just go ride it.
This is the part of the podcast called Just Gotta Ride It. Now, normally I ask a guest which roller coaster they would save if they could only save one in the world. I'm going to slightly expand that for you guys. You could, I'll say it's any themed attraction. Okay, so it could be a dark ride.
That's even harder.
So basically you can choose to save any ride in the world. It doesn't have to be a roller coaster. It could be a roller coaster. Let's start with you, Alex. Which one would you go for? What's your Just Gotta Ride It?
There are so many.
this gives me time to think. Thank
this
you.
Is so many. I think just because of the how I was blown away the first time, and I think it'll probably be Velocicoaster is something that I probably would keep, because it is just something I could ride multiple times, and I have such a fun, scary experience every single time.
Alex is one of the best people to ride a roller coaster with. I was on Velocicoaster with him as he's talking about that, and it was fantastic. It adds to the experience to go on. With Alex, just
I'm a screamer.
You a screamer? I was going to say, Alex, are you a screamer?
I'm a screamer. Yeah.
My mum went on Velocicoaster, and she genuinely thought she was going to fall out.
Very brave.
Like, she genuinely didn't understand.
It's a great
restraint
system, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's really freeing. Am I safe? Yeah, I think I am. I trust Universal. Yeah.
Okay. Good one. We like that. We're fingers crossing for a Velocicoaster in the UK as well, just from our side of things. So we've got everything crossed. If Universal happens, that they'll bring one of those over here. Right, Andy, your time is up. You need to make a decision.
If I'm really on the spot here, I'm going to go, Kev mentioned it earlier, Tower of Terror, the original one, the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror in Hollywood Studios, because I remember going on that as a kid when it first opened, and I was absolutely terrified. And it just goes to show that, you know, Disney can take a, you know, what is essentially like a drop tower and redress that with an incredible story. And yes, of course, it is IP with Tower of Terror, but it's, you know, an expansion of that. But what I particularly loved about that was the sign at the front. I remember seeing the sign with the fiber optics kind of change. I was like, okay, there's something happening here. It was decrepit. You got a sense of this looming kind of, danger. Something's happened. You had that kind of eerie, kind of dark piano-y music in the gardens with the mist coming through, unsettling. And then you go down to the boiler room. So every single part of that story was building and building. So when you do get into that lift, you're in such a state of heightened terror and panic. And then you survive. You don't die, and you come off and you love it. And it's you laugh and you have that sense of relief, and then you want to go back on it again. So I think
That is why it's my number one, Andy,
I would
definitely.
agree with you, Kev. I think that's a fantastic. So for all the things it does, it's not just about the thrill. And we talk about you can put a drop coaster anywhere, a drop ride, but to add that level of story to it and make it so, and it's been since 1994 going strong. So absolutely, and I love the fact that the fifth dimension scene we actually move forward. I think was inspired, and it's a shame that the others don't have that one. But yeah,
It's
classic.
very true.
Both excellent choices. Can't fight you with those at all.
What about you two? Come on, let's go. Here we go.
Mine was the Grand National at Blackpool Pleasure Beach,
Oh,
which
right.
was a very
Classic.
controversial choice.
Classic.
Very, very controversial. Enthusiasts either love it or hate it, but for me, it was just one of the first rides I went on. I just think everyone's got to go and ride it
Nostalgia.
once.
Love it. Yeah, absolutely.
And mine was Nemesis Reborn as the coaster. But if I
Oh.
was allowed to pick another one, I wasn't given that option.
Oh, here we go. He's complaining now.
Wasn't given that option. And so I would have said Tower of Terror.
Oh,
Yeah. Wow.
fantastic.
Or Big Thunder Mountain, Disneyland Paris. I can't
John Maudley's was Big Thunder Mountain.
It is that it well, it's a completely unique, isn't it? Because it goes under the water and you have
One of the
that really
best.
and it fit and makes you feel like you're going so much faster than you're actually going, purely because you're in the dark. And with these new effects with the fuses and the explosion, yeah, it's lovely.
Yeah. So I've got
Amazing.
three.
There's
Sorry.
three for my top one. I've got
My
three. I
top
love
one is actually three,
it.
depending on the category we're going for here.
It's not in the
So,
spirit of the feature, but there we go. Well, I'll try and save them all for you. I can't promise anything. Andy, Alex, thank you so much once again for coming on Parkcast. It's been fascinating speaking to you. We will keep our eyes on some announcements from Catapult about these sneaky little rides that you're working on. And we wish you guys all the best over the next couple of years. I can't wait to see what you get up to. And please come back on in the future. We'd love to catch up with you again.
We'd love
Yeah,
to.
we'd
Thank you
love
very
to. It's been
much.
really, really fun. Thank you so much for having
So much
us.
fun talking to you guys. Thank you so
So
much for having us.
much fun. All right, guys, have a great day. If you did enjoy today's episode, please do give us a rating. It helps. And if you subscribe, you're going to get a notification every time we release a new episode. For now, though, we've been Parkcast.
Parkcast. The UK's original theme park podcast.